Hello and welcome to Pedagogzilla, the pedagogy podcaster. You know what? I'm gonna use Mike's recording of it because I just cannot get my mouth around this. Over to you, Mike.
Hello and welcome to Pedagogzilla, the pedagogy podcast with the pop culture core.
So, I am Mark, I am man with a microphone, and I am imposter syndrome incarnate because I am taking over from Mike for this particular episode, and Rebecca is going to be my capable co-host. So, Rebecca, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Rebecca Ferguson, innovator of pedagogies and also Professor Emerita at the Open University in Learning Futures.
And our guest for this episode is Dom. So Dom, just tell the listeners who you are.
Hello, I'm Dom Pates. I'm a edtech square peg that tries to juggle multiple round holes. And I'm also a senior educational technologist at City St George's University of London.
And I should have said that it's not really pop culture this time. It's classical culture, because our stupid question is, what can we learn from an odyssey through virtual reality? So yes, our question will be clashing together as Schiller and Charybdis clash together the concepts of virtual reality, Homer, the odyssey, and along the way, education.
Part one, the question.
So I suppose we could kick off with the odyssey. So Dom, do you want to tell us a little bit about the Odyssey in general, and we'll dig into the specifics of it when we get into the part two of
absolutely. So the Odyssey is one of the two major epics of ancient Greek literature that are attributed to Homer, a man, we think, who may or may not have existed, maybe a figment of myth, or may have been a real bard of his time. It's one of the oldest surviving works of literature and remains very popular still with modern audiences. The Iliad, which is the sort of first one, covers the Trojan War within that particular period. And the Odyssey is essentially the journey back from the Trojan War by the king of Ithaca, whose name is Odysseus, back to his original island of Ithaca and back to his family. And it takes him around about 10 years to get back there because he goes through all of these adventures and these journeys and these challenges and these monsters along the way that stop him from returning. Many perils, and many of his crewmates are killed, and you know, he has to try and finally find his way back to his family at the end as well. It's a book with a lot of very big themes like homecoming, wandering, testing, guest friendship, etc. One of the biggest works in the Western canon, really.
So, Rebecca, you've kind of revised the Odyssey for this recording. Do you want to fill in anything more on that?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about the Odyssey is that it really brings out the feminine characters that are engaged around the Odyssey itself. So in the Iliad, everybody's off at war. It's all a story of men fighting, men's valour, you know, men doing stupid things together, that sort of thing. Coming back, there's much more of a perspective of here's the goddess Athena helping out Odysseus. Here's his wife Penelope at home fending off over 100 suitors and trying to deal with things. Here are nymphs and goddesses trying to waylay him. Another thing is there's a big focus, I think, on the enslaved people who were such a focus of that character, of that culture. There was continually this danger that you might get swept away and sold into slavery. There's a point where Odysseus is posing as a beggar. He's threatened with being sold off. And when you get the stories from individual slaves, they quite often turn out to have been princes or princesses in their home realm and have been swept away, and now they're swine herds, or they're cupbearers, or doing other sort of fairly menial things. So it's a very different perspective from what you might expect from a classical work.
Okay. I mean, I haven't read it. I have heard the audiobook read by Derek Jacobi, but it was really good for helping me get to sleep. And also, about the only thing I remember from it is how to pronounce Nausicaa, which actually comes in quite useful because it's one of my favourite Studio Ghibli movies. But I'm afraid that's my entire input to the whole thing. So, and now the other part of the question, virtual reality. So, Dom, do you want to just talk about how you're looking at virtuality and what aspects of it you're going to be talking about?
Yeah, and I suspect that we'll all probably have quite differing takes on how we might actually define it as well. So yeah, it's a medium, and I think that's important as a distinction. So in the same way that theatre, that pop music, in the same way that cinema are different forms of media, virtual reality is also a medium. It's an immersive medium and fully immersive in that it's usually experienced through face-worn, head-mounted displays, where you can't see the real world around you. You can only see the sort of simulated environment that's been created for your senses to experience. And a lot of my more recent understanding of it comes from a Stanford academic called Jeremy Bailenson, who wrote a book a few years ago called Experience on Demand. And there's a couple of things that I think are quite important from his definitions there that have really helped my understanding. So he frames it as an entirely new medium, which I think encompasses lots of other ones as well, and that it has its own characteristics and psychological effects, and that in his view, it is far more psychologically powerful than any medium ever invented, which is quite a tall ask or order for it. And the other thing that Bailenson says that it is that virtual reality or VR is able to effectively blur the line between reality and illusion, granting us access to any experience imaginable. And maybe wow. I'll just hand over to you two to see if you've got anything you would add to that.
Rebecca, what do you make of that then?
I think that is a good and useful definition. I think it's worth saying that you would generally interact with the virtual world or virtual reality in the form of an avatar. Not always. I mean, sometimes you're moving around an environment and you can't see yourself or other people can't see you, but usually you'd have some sort of representation of yourself within that context. I think it's also worth sort of distinguishing it from augmented reality these days, because that's something people might get confused about. I hear these terms, augmented reality, extended reality, virtual reality, and it's very difficult if you're not engaged with those to know the difference. So just to come back to augmented reality, that's when you've got an overlay on the real world, the physical world, so you can see something of the real or physical world, depending how you refer to it. But you can also see, you might have information put on top of that. You might have models put on top of that. You might have live action put on top of that. You might have a soundtrack put on top of that. Whereas in virtual reality, you're wholly within this new created environment. Think that makes sense, Dom?
Very much so. The only thing I would add to that as well is that it's often used as a vehicle for playing back 360-degree video as well. So in that case, it's kind of, you could almost consider it within the oeuvre of cinematic media, but it's where you feel like you are fully part of the action, not as an avatar, but as a sort of unobserved character within that, and where you can sort of look around in all environments and see what would be happening as if you were in a filmed real environment, as opposed to a sort of screen that you might see at one end of a cinema or a TV.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really big distinction, because you've got the video-based virtual reality, which is what you're just talking about, but which is effective because it looks like the real thing and it looks like you're there. You can look around and see it, but you don't have a body within it. Whereas the stuff Rebecca and I have looked at, where you actually have a body and go into a shared social world that is digitally created, that's better in some ways and worse in others. There's different balances between the different things. And I guess another thing to think about is the headset's not necessarily a prerequisite for a virtual reality, and that some of the things that Dom and I have looked at, you can access the same environment either through a desktop or through the headset. So clarifying sometimes, is this headset VR, is this screen-based VR? And also, you know, it's not entirely different in that there's precursors. So the term virtual reality was coined by Antoine Artaud in the beginning of the 20th century, and he was talking about theatre as a virtual reality, as a separate world that you can enter into, and there are different rules and playfulness and all those sorts of things. And one of my favourite books is a book called As If, and I'll put the links in the show notes, and that's talking about narrative precursors. So he's saying that as long as you've got a separate world that lots of people collaborate on and take on identities within it and share those experiences with each other and then bring that back out into the physical world, it still is a form of virtual reality in itself, really. So you've got that psychological immersion because you're reading a book that somebody else has created and you're interacting with them through the text that you're creating. And in which case, virtual reality goes all the way back to the Brontes, because they're the ones who first did that sort of thing. And so you've got, you know, with their Glasstown Confederacy and all that sort of stuff. So yes, I think there's something that's very different about the experience of putting a headset on and looking and feeling like you're in a completely different world. But it's not entirely different from things that have gone before and experiences you get in other media.
I would say what we're talking about today is the technologically mediated version of that. Because, you know, you could, a Dungeons and Dragons game, for example, would be a virtual reality, but we're not specifically talking about that. We're talking about you're either looking at a screen or you're looking through a headset.
And any of the experiences that I'll be describing today have all been experienced through a digital head-mounted display as well. So
that's key. Okay, because that's what we want to talk about today in the next bit. Dom?
Yeah, I was just going to add one more thing, and again, this is going back to Bailenson again as well. And I think this is quite an important factor to understand with VR. Is Bailenson talks about VR engendering a sense of physical presence or of being there. So in his view, it's better understood as an actual experience rather than as a media experience, or obviously as a mediated experience. So I think that's one of the quite interesting things about, and it's very much going to depend on the kind of fidelity of the experience, but where video-based VR is particularly useful, it feels like you're there.
And I think, yeah, you're right, that's key. Yeah, it's a sort of coin. The thing I've just read from Heidegger, it's an ontic experience that you can talk about, you know, ontologically what it means, but it's embedded in the physicality of the body and the experience of the body. And at that kind of visceral level, it's one of the few media, I think, using it in different technologies to teach, where you don't really get it by explaining it to someone. It's only when you put that headset on and you see it and you feel it that you really get a sense of what its potential is, really. No matter how much you talk about it or show pictures of it, that's not conveyed by anything else other than putting that headset on and looking around inside it.
I think before we move on to the next phase, it might be worth just talking about virtual reality and education and sort of how it's used in education, because I think something we've all found is that people, with all educational technology, there's this thing about shiny. You know, here is a new shiny thing, let's try out the new shiny thing. And there have been people who've gone, oh yeah, virtual reality is a new shiny thing. It's really exciting, it's fun. But they haven't really thought about what they're trying to achieve with it in education. So as soon as it stops being shiny and fun, they move on to the next thing. Yeah. Whereas the people who really stuck with it in have used it for things which you couldn't do otherwise because they're difficult, because they're dangerous, or because they'd just be impossible to do otherwise.
Yeah, and also to explore things like identity. It's you know, to experience different things as a different kind of person within a social world. So Obviously, a big topic, lots of different ways through it, which is why we're taking this particular course, which is Dom, to talk about his experiences of adapting to or understanding or applying VR, but using the Odyssey as a sort of storyboard or as a checklist or as a process for exploring that sort of stuff. So that's what we're going to do in the second part. Dom's going to talk about what that Odyssey is and then look at his experiences of virtual reality through that lens. So just aware that I'm not doing this quite as professionally as Michael would do it, but we will then segue to the next bit of the question.
Part two, the answer.
And I forgot the question already. Keep going, Mark. You'll get the hang of it. So what can we learn about an Odyssey through virtual reality? Now, Dom has given me bullet points for all the different steps of the Odyssey. So he's split it into departures, adventures, and I need to scroll down to see what the bottom bit is. You tell me what the third bit is, Dom.
Return, transform.
Return and transformation. Okay, so departures, heading off to Troy. Dom, do you want to tell us a little bit about the Odyssey and the bit where all the Greeks head off to Troy? What's all that about then, Dom?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways to think about this. I mean, the Odyssey itself as a narrative, although you can look at it from a linear perspective, a lot of it is told through flashbacks and memories and things like that. So it doesn't necessarily follow a strict linear path, but you can quite clearly see a sort of departure, call to adventure as some sort of beginning. The actual beginning of the book itself is something along the lines of the goddess Athena trying to prompt Odysseus, who's the main character, his son, who I've tended to pronounce as Telemachus during my life, but I think it can also be Telemachus. Well, either which of those should be fine. So Athena prompting the son of the eponymous hero to try to seek him out. So we could look at this as a sort of, you know, Odysseus getting called to go off to the Battle of Troy as something that is understood as a departure. That means to get called off to adventure there, or for his son getting called to seek him out and to do this sort of stuff as well. What I've tried to do here, and this is for a forthcoming book chapter, what I've tried to do is map various different stages in the journey to various different activities that I've experienced on my own learning journey about virtual reality itself. So what are some of the things that happened along the way while I've been trying to understand the medium and what its applicability might be in teaching and learning, if anything? Mm-hmm. So it's quite a convoluted mashup of various different bits and bobs, but trying to figure those various things out. So I suppose my very earliest signals came from you, Mark. So full disclosure to listeners, Mark was my A-level media studies teacher in the early 90s at a college in Cardiff. And I think, I was looking back through my notes the other day. I mean, you know, I've still got some scans of my old A-level notes. I couldn't find anything in it. So maybe it's just in my own head. But I'm sure as we got to the end of the course, there was something right at the very end that said, "And the future of media is this." I think we had, you know, half a lesson or something on people with these big hairdresser style helmets on, where they were half the size of somebody's body and you couldn't see what was going on in there, but they were transformed to another world and, you know, this kind of stuff taken off elsewhere. And that was my introduction to the concept of virtual reality. But it wasn't until something like 15, 20 years later that I actually got to experience it myself for the first time. So my call to adventure, if you like, one of the experiences that was fairly formative for me early on. Now, this was as an educational technologist at the university I work in now, and had a PhD student that was doing some research on the impact of scent in VR. And this was, so I was a subject of his study, and essentially I was put into a simulation of the Alps, and I was made to do some climbing, And I got these different experiences of it. So the first one was kind of an unskinned version of these virtual Alps. So I had to get used to the practice of climbing in VR, falling down off a cliff without sort of breaking my legs and all this kind of stuff. Then I got this sort of digitized simulation of the Alps, and you know, I'd climb up, you know, standing in an office room in London. But in my head, I was climbing the Alps and I could look down and see these sort of alpine streams and these sort of deer supping away at the stream and all this kind of stuff. And then the final stage was where the researcher started to sort of spray the scent of alpine flowers into the room that I was standing in. So it was, you know, does adding an extra scent help with the sense of immersion?
Wow, that's really interesting.
And did it?
As far as I can remember, I think it did, yeah.
It's not really something you think about, really. It's like, you know, it's like there were scent organs, weren't there, for sort of movies and things at one point. And I remember being in an immersive theatrical experience, cinema experience, where there was a little thing in the chair in front of you that sprayed things at you at different times and released different scents at different times.
Smell-o-vision.
Or maybe, yeah, like Smell-o-vision, yeah. Or maybe I just saw that in Kentucky Fried Movie or something. I can't remember. But anyway, so, yeah. So, Rebecca, I mean, I hadn't thought of that, but since I've known you after you got involved in the whole VR stuff, but what was your call to adventure then? What was your Athena prompt?
Mine was quite prosaic. I was doing some research on how people learn together online, and I was looking at a specific course which had, I don't know, I've forgotten, 150 students on it, and they had to do projects together, and they had to do these projects virtually. And the person who was organising the course said, oh, we're experimenting with doing this in virtual reality in Second Life. And I thought, well, that sounds very, very exciting and very novel. Let me go and explore Second Life, which at that point, the university had got so many firewalls set up. It had got its computers set up so they couldn't download Second Life. It took a huge amount of perseverance, actually, to get into this virtual world and to find out what was going on. I've got blog posts about my first experiences in there, and it's like, I look like some sort of disaster victim.
So it didn't immediately grab you then? Because that's the thing.
The idea grabbed me, but the physicality of it, you know, there was so much struggling against the system. And we found this afterwards, you know, when we were working with teenagers, that just the barriers their school put in between them and accessing all the things they could do in virtual reality made it absolutely impossible for children in some schools or some education systems to get there.
I mean, Dom and you talking about that sort of moment, because I was on my, I think I just finished the first year of my PhD, I was doing it part-time, and I was doing something on mathematical modelling and mathematical games, game worlds they called them. So it's basically you change the physics and then the maths and the physics works out differently. And it was quite dull and I wasn't really getting on very well with it. I spent a lot of time making my own comic books and things instead. So at the end of the first year, I hadn't got very far at all. And then my supervisor left. But also I was running a conference at that time, and three of the presentations at that conference were on different virtual worlds, different bits of virtual reality. And I thought, immediately, this is amazing. This is transformative. And it just grabbed my attention in a way that nothing else had at that point. And I'm getting the impression that for Dom, that was something similar. It was a call to adventure. It was, all the other things are, oh, that's interesting, but these are strange new worlds. That's a coin of phrase.
Yeah, and I think, you know, but both of your points really chime as well. I mean, you know, Rebecca's made it clear how challenging it can be to use virtual reality as a teaching tool. It's way easier to give your students a textbook and some paper and pens and, you know, take it from there. But, you know, if you want to take them on a trip to Mars, then there's only one way to do that, and that's to do it in VR. And if you want to do that, then you have to contend with all of the challenges, whether it's firewalls, the inability to see what they're seeing, et cetera, et cetera. but also as a, I suppose, media scholar, is also kind of quite fascinating to be at a time when a new medium emerges and to be able to work through some of the challenges of it as well. When cinema first came out, you know, there wasn't any sound in it, and you had to have an orchestra playing at the front to be able to get any sense of emotion to really properly come across. Yeah, so there were lots of drawbacks, and you know, VR likewise is lots of difficulties. But at the same time, to go back to Balanson, it's also a remarkably powerful medium as well, and which is something that gives it great applicability in education when it can be done, used well and used correctly, or appropriately rather.
So that's departures then. Now let's get into the adventures. Now the first of the adventures that you wanted to highlight, Dom, are the Lotus Eaters. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Lotus Eaters in The Odyssey then?
Yeah, so the Lotus Eaters were they were island dwellers, and on Odysseus's journey there were lots of islands that he stopped at along the way. The Lotus Eaters were people who ate this intoxicating fruit, which made them forget about, the sailors forget about reaching home as well. So it's kind of like taking you to another mental space completely and forget about what it is that you're doing.
How does that apply to your VR experience then?
Well, this is an experience that came a little bit more recently. In fact, it was only within the last 12 months, I think. So there was a big initiative at my place on using VR for well-being. And we had a company that was working with some of our health and medical science students and our engineering students, and had developed this app that I suppose could only really, my closest analogy was that it was a sort of hypnosis app. If you look at if you have a smartwatch, you have a kind of well-being app on it, and you press it and you've got to breathe in and breathe out for a minute, and it has this sort of pulsing sea anemone type look to it. Well, this was this sort of thing was recreated in VR. It was like putting your head into a kaleidoscope and having a sort of soothing voice go over it at the same time. And part of what they were looking into was the effect on stress for students as they geared up for exams. So, you know, they previously put in petting zoos and all these other kinds of means of reducing student stress. You know, this time they sort of put them in a Lotus Eater Island and see if it made them feel less vexed about a coming exam.
Rebecca, did you want to come in on that?
Used a very similar app in VR, and they ask you at the beginning, you know, how stressed do you feel at the moment, how anxious do you feel, and then they ask you at the end, how stressed and anxious do you feel. And I think it did appear to be quite a successful thing, and it does switch you out of what you're thinking about into thinking about sort of kaleidoscopy patterns. So yeah, did it work with students or when you put it out in the real world?
Supposedly. Those that participated in it said it made them feel more relaxed. I mean, I didn't follow them through on their individual journeys to see how well they, you know, have a look at their exam results and the sort of those who did and those who didn't. But they enjoyed the experience. Now, whether that's the same thing as they felt less stressed and therefore better able to take some exams, I mean, I don't know.
So for me, when I saw Lotus Eaters there and you were talking about them being sort of lulled into this state of distraction and not wanting to progress, was what it called to mind for me was working with students in VR is how it's very difficult when you first put them into this sort of environment to get them to do the educational thing you want them to do. Because I've got a transcript of some students and it's like, oh, look, I've taken magic mushrooms. Wow, I'm flying. Oh my God, everything's just changed. Because they found something that if you clicked on it, it just changed the way that all the visuals looked within that space. So I think that is part of the prop. Sometimes that can help, but often it's a hindrance to learning. And I think that's one of the things you have to think about when you're looking at different technologies is, to what extent is all of the great stuff that you can do not necessarily helpful because it takes students away from it, lures them into kind of just sitting around messing about, really. One of the strategies I found for overcoming some of that is to have a session to start off with that was entirely, let's put the tech on, let's all play about, let's all have fun, or doing different things or changing our avatars or just teleporting or whatever, and then stop that session and then the next time have something and have a real sort of boundary between the exploring and having fun, which is a great way to adapt yourself to the technology. But then it's like, okay, lotus eating over. Let's get
drop
on and do
lotuses.
The thing. Yeah, drop your loti, whatever the plural is, lotuses. And this time we're actually going to do the work at hand. And I think that ended up being quite a useful strategy. But
and I think that's one of the reasons why you've got to think really carefully about how you're using virtual reality, because you've got that session, you know, which is half an hour or an hour, where they're learning to use the technology. And if that's not a particular learning outcome of your course, then you've got to have a really good reason for them spending that hour. And there are really good reasons for that. But if you're just doing it to, it would be fun to do exactly what we were going to do in class, but in virtual reality, which is what some people do, then it's wasting their time.
The biggest risk of introducing shiny into the classroom.
Because everyone's going, ooh, shiny, totally, and not distracts. Actually doing anything else.
Yeah.
So let's look at the Phaeacians then.
The Phaeacians are sort of, they're related to the gods and the giants, and they have these miraculous ships which they use to help travellers get home, which is very handy for Odysseus. But there is this prophecy that one day the gods will turn against them on this. And in fact, it happens to be when they take Odysseus home, when they come back. And they've been lovely to him. They've welcomed him. They've given him all the hospitality that you ought to give, which is demonstrated all the way through the Odyssey, how you ought to behave to guests, how you ought to behave to strangers. And they are absolutely exemplary in this. And they zoom Odysseus back to Ithaca. And their boat goes so fast that it sort of almost goes up the beach. And then, sadly, the gods take against them for that, and when they go back, they are turned into stone.
Wow.
It's very sad, which just goes to show that, you know, you can do all the right things, but
no good deed goes unpunished. Yeah. So what does that tell you about VR then, Dom?
Well, one of the other functions of the Phaeacians in the Odyssey is that they give Odysseus a space to tell his story. So he's escaped from Calypso's island with the help of the gods, and he's got this sort of, you know, long litany of experiences bubbling up inside him, and they give him a space to tell the story. The analogy here I found with VR is that, simply put, is that VR can be a very effective tool for storytelling. And the one particular app that I drew on from my experience here. So there is an app called Ecosphere, which has these it's sort of climate and nature related documentaries. There's not quite 360, more 180 degree. So you can look left, right and in front of you and above, but not behind you. These sort of 180 video documentaries. And these are ones I was considering using in a class as well. So I sat down in an office, put the headset on and tried one of these out. And this was one that was an app that was set in a rainforest in Borneo. And the sort of story that they're trying to tell is about deforestation and palm oil plantations and all this kind of stuff. And one of the things that was, you know, you got local people sort of kneeling or standing a certain distance away from the 360 camera and talking to it directly. And it was a bit of different positioning from, you know, how you would in a regular documentary. But it was like sort of talking to somebody who was sat quite close by you. And the thing that made the most impression on me was I remember sort of sitting in this jungle clearing and having this orangutan sort of clamber down these vines in front of my face. And it's just sort of sitting there in an office in London with a load of boxes around me, staring up in wonder at this orangutan climbing down in front of me and not getting scared away from me or anything like that.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a different medium. You know, it is a new art form. We can tell stories in different ways than we've been able to before, I guess, through this sort of thing. We can do things. It's not it is visual, it is like cinema, but it's also maybe it's automated avatars or interactions. It's like the holodeck off Star Trek or something like that. We don't know yet, I guess, because it is so new, where this could go in terms of being able to create narratives and connect to each other and tell stories in different ways than we've been able to before, I think.
What's it like for journalists? When journalism, news journalism, starts making more effective use of this medium, what does that do for our understanding of the world around us?
So the final stage of the journey that we're going to talk about is Dom has called Return Transformed. And the first of these is Odysseus and Telemachus Reunited.
So after his experiences of storytelling and feasting with the Phaeacians and Hermes helping to, or Athena, I think, helping to get Odysseus back to Ithaca. He doesn't just, after, you know, 10, 20 long years away, just sort of turn up re-announced and say, I'm home. And he can't because, you know, his household is under threat. His wife, the Queen Penelope, is fending off a gang of suitors who are looking to marry her in his absence. His son is wondering where his father is. So he, as he returns to Ithaca, he does so initially in disguise. So the goddess Athena disguises him as an elderly beggar. And first of all, he gets offered a place to stay and some food from the swineherd Eumaeus. And then eventually he ends up crossing paths with his son Telemachus, who Odysseus reveals himself to his son. And eventually son realizes that father is home, and they start plotting on how they can sort of retake the household.
And let's point out that because Odysseus has been away for 20 years, he left Telemachus as a baby in arms. So here is Telemachus, he's grown to adulthood, but he's never actually seen his father. So it's almost not being reunited, it's like meeting his father for the first time.
Right. How does this relate to your experience of VR then, Dom?
I said at the beginning that, Mark, you introduced me to VR, even though you don't remember it, back as an A-level student. So I was sort of playing on, sort of teacher and student coming back together again. And I remembered an experience that you and I had several discussions about the implications of VR and the use in teaching. And we ended up having a shared social VR experience, because that was one thing that I hadn't had very much experience of. And by the sounds of it, for both of you with your experiences in Second Life, it's something that you'd had a lot more experience of, but I hadn't had very much. So Mark, you invited me to join you in a meeting on a platform called Engage VR, which was sort of cross headset. And there were a couple of places there and spoke to each other. I mean, you were in your house, I was in mine. But we were both on the surface of Mars while we were speaking together. And there were some fascinating sort of, you know, things that I remember from that particular experience. So, you know, while we were on Mars and you were showing me how to interact with this kind of tablet controller that you pull up out of your wrist, so it gave you access to all of these different tools, I set off a flock of birds on the surface of Mars. And, you know, the scientist in me goes, yeah, God, as soon as you set off a flock of birds on Mars, they'll all drop dead. Lack of atmosphere and all that. Yeah, but, I was looking around in my headset as this flock of pigeons flew over my head while we were on the surface of Mars. But then after that, we teleported to the next experience, which was in Shakespeare's Globe Theatre. And you and I were standing on the stage of the Globe, and the recreation of it in the app was, you know, obviously designed to be as close to the experience might have looked in the Elizabethan era. So I remember standing on the stage, looking out at where the audience would be, and seeing the sort of blue sky and the white clouds above. And, wow, it's just like, you know, in the Elizabethan age, it looked like just like it does today. But it was fascinating way to learn about the things that you can do in VR from a social point of view. Because, as we said earlier, learning is a social thing as much as it's an individual thing. And if you only keep your students in isolation in there, then you're missing the opportunities that they get from learning from each other.
Yeah. And also, you recounting that reveals another aspect of it, which is, and there's some neurological evidence for this as well, that memories that are formed in games and in virtual reality are stored in the same part of the brain as memories that are formed in the physical world. It's not like it's a different kind of experience. Obviously, it's simulated. Part of that is the way that narratives unfold within it. So, you know, the birds flying overhead is a sort of serendipitous thing that wouldn't necessarily happen in other media, but also because you're embodied with it, it has more impact on, I think, the way that you relate to it. So I remember it was a simulation of an oil rig that Gilly Salmon's group set up at Leicester, and people were like exploring the oil rig, and then there was a sort of alarm went off and we all evacuated, and it took us through the whole evacuation process. And then we were talking about the experience afterwards, or people were. And I have a huge number of different skins, so I kind of transform into different things all the time within Second Life. And I was swimming around outside the oil rig as a fish. And then there's two guys talking about what it worked, what didn't work about it. And I'm just listening in. And then I say something, and then they go, "That fish is a person." Just the moment of shock. I still remember, because it was something serendipitous that unfolded that, you know, it can't happen in any, I don't think, in other media, because they're more controlled, they're more locked down. We're not embodied and sharing them in the same place as standing on the on the stage of the globe and looking around and wondering what it's like. Those are the memorable things.
But also talking about being a fish.
Yeah.
That's like what Odysseus is doing, because Athena changes him several times when he comes back to Ithaca. You know, he sort of vacillates between being an old, wizened beggar and his normal self. And then sometimes she gives him sort of godlike beauty and strength. And I think that's like VR, in that you can take on different characters, different personas, and you can experience the same situation from different perspectives and in different ways. Mm. And that's what you were doing with fish, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was just mucking about, but it actually...
Fish be doing? You're right, but that's probably what fish are doing most of the time anyway.
Just mucking about, that's what fish do.
Yeah, just mucking around, yeah, watching the oil rigs, yeah. So you ended on, but what of the Trojan horse? Because we all know what the story of the Trojan horse, but what do you mean by that question?
So as I was going on this journey, I was mindful throughout of the role of the Trojan horse in Odysseus's own journey. Now, the wooden horse of Troy, which was basically how Odysseus and his soldiers won the battle, you know, by giving this massive wooden horse to the Trojans that was actually stuffed full of soldiers who came out at night and, you know, slaughtered the city dwellers and won the war. But that happened in the Iliad, not in the Odyssey. So, Rebecca, you mentioned earlier, you know, Odysseus does tell the story to some of the other characters he encounters on the way. And as I was going through this, I was thinking, well, there must be an analogy somewhere in my own journey into virtual reality that chimes with the Trojan horse. What is it that looks so promising, yet has all these hidden dangers in it? And I came up with a parallel. I went to a showcase day at the Meta offices in King's Cross. And this was lots of different presentations from Meta and other partners talking about the transformative power of VR in higher education. They had lots of smaller app platforms who were showcasing their wares, giving lots of people the experience to do so, and obviously looking to accelerate adoption of the platform and the tools and the apps within the higher education landscape. And as I was sitting there with my critical, cynical edtech hat on in the basically Facebook's London office and thinking, do I feel like a fish out of water here? Do I feel like I'm in the wrong place here or something? And as I ended up speaking to people during the course of the day, Yeah, I realise that one of the reasons why virtual reality is so much more commonplace these days on its journey towards becoming a more mainstream medium is that it's been heavily invested in by Facebook, became Meta. And I thought, well, I remember I stopped using Facebook after the Edward Snowden revelations around all of the surveillance stuff that was happening and all the harnessing of people's data and, you know, the profiling that was happening along there as well. And it occurred to me that, well, all of this surveillance, capitalism, advertising wealth had basically gone into accelerating this particular medium that could be argued to be acting as a Trojan horse.
For data collection, for getting more surveillance into our homes, for that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, the standard Facebook platform was whatever text or images from your personal life that you'd chosen to share with this digital advertising company. And, you know, because it was free, you'd become the product. What the evolution of Facebook into Meta became an even greater data harvesting operation, because it can track your eye movements, can track lots of your physicality, your actual...
Gait recognition. I mean, one of the things about surveillance, more than a lot of facial stuff, is gait recognition. So if you're walking around, gait, G-A-I-T, gait, if you're walking around in VR, it's getting all of that gait data about how you walk and about how you move and about your posture and everything, which can be used for tracking on surveillance cameras. So what you're saying, in short, Dom, is beware geeks bearing gifts.
Exactly that.
I had to get that in. Yeah. Sorry, did you anything? So were you going to say something?
I hope you prepared that line.
No, I thought about it just then.
Perfect. Beware geeks bearing gifts. That's exactly right.
Okay, so I think we've reached the end of our odyssey then. So have we answered the question? So what can we learn from an odyssey through virtual reality? What comes out of all of this? To summarize,
well, what I've learnt through from my odyssey into virtual reality is that this is a new and emerging medium that combines many other media of the past, that has a broad array of applicabilities to support teaching and learning. VR can be a very powerful educational technology for reasons like the sense of presence that it can present, the ability to, you know, go somewhere else, be someone else, experience things that you couldn't normally experience in any other way, time travel, space travel, you know, becoming a blood cell or an atom or an ant, or a refugee, or, you know, all sorts of things. It can be very powerful as an empathy machine, but there are a very significant list of reasons when you shouldn't use it as well. The first question to come in really is, does this need to be in VR? You know, look at your learning objectives and look at whatever is in your toolkit currently doesn't allow you to meet your learning objectives. Maybe VR is an option there. Yeah.
Rebecca, is anything then about answering that question?
No, I think that's fine. I feel Dom has answered the question.
For me, I'm going to go a bit meta here and actually look at the process that you've introduced us to here, which is to look at our experiences through the lens of a particular journey, so a story about a journey, because I think that's a really interesting way of doing it as well, is sometimes even just by forcing a metaphor that doesn't really work, you're reframing that experience in a way and looking at different things that have happened. So by taking those stages, looking at a story like that, and then going, how does that relate to my experiences? I think that unpacks a lot of really interesting things that I think maybe we can look at more in the final part of the show, which is part three, tips for your own practice.
Part three, practical tips.
We've answered the question. We have found some things that we can learn from an odyssey through VR. But having learned those things, does that change how we do stuff? How do we apply some of what we've learned to our practice in general? Dom, do you want to start on that?
Well, I'm going to draw again on Baylinson. So Baylinson and Homer are my map and compass for this particular journey. And there's a few things that are highly applicable from Baylinson that are really appropriate for thinking about in general, but particularly in teaching and learning. So, you know, as I mentioned, ask yourself, does this need to be in VR? You know, if it doesn't need to be in VR, don't put it in VR. Some of the sort of subsets of considerations you might find there. So presence in VR leads to absence in the physical world. So, you know, if you're going through on a journey through a vein as a blood cell, you don't realize that you're going to be stepping on a mate's foot in the classroom.
Yeah.
Be mindful of the gap between the two there. It's perfect for things that you couldn't do in the real world. Say, don't waste the medium on the mundane. So say VR for the truly special moments. I mean, you know, the International Space Station observation was, you know, you can have some nice reflective questions on the nature of the Earth if you spend 5 minutes in the module looking at the planet from above. You know, make it special. And there's a couple of very sort of, you know, quite practical ones as well. So don't make people sick. You know, it's quite common to talk about motion sickness as a risk here. You know, whatever you do, don't make people sick from it, because, you know, they're going to remember that more than they're going to remember the experience, never mind anything they learn from it. Be safe. That kind of, again, goes with the point about not stepping on somebody in the classroom or tripping over a tethered wire or something like that. And again, I think, generally speaking, you know, less is more. I mean, you know, although I spent 2.5 hours watching Blade Runner in there, I don't think that was really meant for a learning experience in that. So, you know, if the experience is particularly intense, then even just 5 or 10 minutes is probably enough. And, you know, just use the unique power of the medium for what it can bring, rather than just using it for the sake of it.
Yeah. Rebecca, is there anything you've wanted?
Yeah, I would echo all those. I'd also say, you know, once you've worked through the dice and, you know, decided, yes, this is too dangerous or difficult or expensive or whatever to do in the real world, then don't just stop there. Think about what the possibilities of virtual reality are. So you're extending learners' interaction with the subject. You're expanding the ways in which they can perceive that subject. It can bring to life times or spaces or characters or possibilities. We've talked about transformational learning in another Pedagogzilla, but it is an opportunity to transform your students, even if only temporarily, into something that they would not normally be. So it gives opportunities where you can not only approaching learning in a meaningful way, but you could also engage with it much more deeply. And those are things that you can really get if you really dig into VR and make good use of it.
Cool. Okay, I'm going to do my more meta thing again, which is there's that stage where Odysseus tells his story to the Phaeacians. And that's why we have basically the stories, because he sat down and he told it all in retrospective and all that happened. That would be my tip, is find opportunities to tell your story, find frameworks to tell your story to each other. You know, look at the medium that VR has, perhaps, and find ways for a story to evolve. It could be a game, or it could be playing around it with the environment, but find things to do within that environment where stories can unfold, and find people to tell your story to. And I think, you know, it could be VR, it could be a writer's group, it could just be sitting down, like I said, playing a game, or it could even be making a podcast. But I think that's where we unfold experiences, and that's where we lay down memories, is that sort of process. And finding metaphors to tell it, and inventing your own metaphors, or pushing together two different kinds of things that don't really fit, I think that is a good way to unpack experiences, particularly if you're struggling to get a chapter written. Really, I was going to ask that. Has this helped you put your ideas together for the thing you've got to write?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's given me different angles that I hadn't yet come to myself.
That's really good.
It's given me a sense of probably the need to edit some of what I've got down.
Yeah.
But it's also given me a way of explaining my through my thinking on this and seeing whether things work or not. I mean, some of these metaphors fitted much better than others. So, yeah, it's been very helpful for that.
Oh, thank you. Right. Well, I will hand over to Mike now, our recording of Mike, to wrap up with all the ways that you can hear about Pedagodzilla.
Thank you so much to you, dear listeners, for listening. If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to us on all of your favourite apps, feeds, iTunes, and at our website, pedagodzilla.com. That's all we have time for today.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And so it just leaves it up for us to sign off. So thank you very much, Dom. Thank you very much, Rebecca. Any way that people, anything, final messages you want for people to get in touch with you or find out more about your work or stuff you want to plug while you're here?
Well, I'll go for one plug. And that is that some listeners may be aware, some may not be aware, that I also co-manage an internet radio station. And in October, the Alt-C Radio will be broadcasting live from the Alt-C conference in Glasgow. So you can find that at the thursdaynightshow.com on the 23rd and 24th of October. So tune in for 48 hours of EdTech Radio.
And I'll be there as well, all being well. And Rebecca?
I will do a plug, a classical plug, for Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, which is a fantastic modern translation of the Odyssey. If you're thinking that all sounds not pop culture enough for me, get into Emily Wilson. It's a great read.
In 2026, Christopher Nolan's filmed version of the Odyssey should be released with Matt Damon as the Odyssey. So we can come back for a sort of Pedagodzilla episode.
Or I can strongly recommend the Derek Jacobi reading it out. It's very entertaining. And if you find reading a big chunky book a bit too difficult, just listen to him. It's a very nice way to send yourself off to sleep. Not saying it's boring, I'm just saying it's very soothing the way he reads it. Very good. Okay, well, thank you, everyone. And we'll leave it there. Looking forward to the chapter when it's written.
Bye.
Bye.